coarse and superficial. But his example awakened the curiosity of an ingenious people, and the light of science was diffused over the dominions of Persia. At Gondi-Sepor, in the neighbourhood of the royal city of Susa, an academy of physic was founded, which insensibly became a liberal school of poetry, philosophy, and rhetoric. The annals of the monarchy were composed, and while recent and authentic history might afford some useful lessons, both to the prince and people, the darkness of the first ages was embellished by the giants, the dragons, and the fabulous heroes of Oriental romance. Every learned or confident stranger was enriched by the bounty and flattered by the conversation of the monarch. He nobly rewarded a Greek physician by the deliverance of 3,000 captives, and the sophists who contended for his favour were exasperated by the wealth and insolence of Uranus, their more successful rival. Nushirvan believed, or at least respected, the religion of the Magi, and some traces of persecution may be discovered in his reign. Yet he allowed himself freely to compare the tenets of the various sects, and the theological disputes, in which he frequently presided, diminished the authority of the priest and enlightened the minds of the people. At his command, the most celebrated writers of Greece and India were translated into the Persian language, a smooth and elegant idiom recommended by Muhammad for the use of paradise, though it is branded with the epithets of savage and unmusical by the ignorance and presumption of Agathias. Yet the Greek historian might reasonably wonder that it should be found possible to execute an entire version of Plato and Aristotle in a foreign dialect which had not been framed to express the spirit of freedom and the subtleties of philosophic disquisition. And if the reason of the Stagirite might be equally dark or equally intelligible in every tongue, the dramatic art and verbal augmentation of the disciple of Socrates appear to be indissolubly mingled with the grace and perfection of his Attic style. In the search of universal knowledge, Nushirvan was informed that the moral and political fables of Pilpai, an ancient Brahman, were preserved with jealous reverence among the treasures of the kings of India. The physician Porozes was secretly dispatched to the banks of the Ganges with instructions to procure, at any price, the communication of this valuable work. His dexterity obtained a transcript. His learned diligence accomplished the translation. Then the fables of Pilpai were read and admired in the assembly of Nushirvan and his nobles. The Indian original and the Persian copy have long since disappeared, but this venerable monument has been saved by the curiosity of the Arabian caliphs, revived in the modern Persic, the Turkish, the Syriac, the Hebrew, and the Greek idioms, and transfused through successive versions into the modern languages of Europe. In their present form, the peculiar character, the manners and religion of the Hindus are completely obliterated, and the intrinsic merit of the fables of Pilpai is far inferior to the concise elegance of Phaedrus and the native graces of La Fontaine. 15 moral and political sentences are illustrated in a series of epilogues, but the composition is intricate, the narrative prolix, and the precept obvious and barren. Yet the Brahman may assume the merit of inventing a pleasing fiction which adorns the nakedness of truth and alleviates, perhaps to a royal ear, the harshness of instruction. With a similar design to admonish kings that they are strong only in the strength of their subjects, the same Indians invented the game of chess, which was likewise introduced into Persia under the reign of Nushirvan. Part 3. The son of Kobad found his kingdom involved in a war with the successor of Constantine, and the anxiety of his domestic situation inclined him to grant the suspension of arms which Justinian was impatient to purchase. Chosroes saw the Roman ambassadors at his feet. He accepted 11,000 pounds of gold as the price of an endless or indefinite peace. Some mutual exchanges were regulated. The Persian assumed the guard of the gates of Caucasus, and the demolition of Dara was suspended on condition that it should never be made the residence of the general of the East. This interval of repose had been solicited and was diligently improved by the ambition of the emperor. His African conquests were the first fruits of the Persian treaty, and the avarice of Chosroes was soothed by a large portion of the spoils of Carthage, which his ambassadors required in a tone of pleasantry and under the colour of friendship. But the trophies of Belisarius disturbed the slumbers of the great king, and he heard with astonishment, envy, and fear that Sicily, Italy, and Rome itself had been reduced in 3 rapid campaigns to the obedience of Justinian. Unpracticed in the art of violating treaties, he secretly excited his bold and subtle vassal, Almondar. That prince of the Saracens, who resided at Hira, had not been included in the general peace, and still waged an obscure war against his rival, Arethas, the chief of the tribe of Gassan, and confederate of the empire. The subject of their dispute was an extensive sheep walk in the desert to the south of Palmyra. An immemorial tribute for the license of pasture appeared to attest the rights of Almondar, while the Gassanite appealed to the Latin name of Strata, a paved road, as an unquestionable evidence of the sovereignty and labors of the Romans. The 2 monarchs supported the cause of their respective vassals, and the Persian Arab, without expecting the event of a slow and doubtful arbitration, enriched his flying camp with the spoil and captives of Syria. Instead of repelling the arms, Justinian attempted to seduce the fidelity of Almondar, while he called from the extremities of the earth the nations of Ethiopia and Scythia to invade the dominions of his rival. But the aid of such allies was distant and precarious, and the discovery of this hostile correspondence justified the complaints of the Goths and Armenians, who implored almost at the same time the protection of Chosroes. The descendants of Arsaces, who were still numerous in Armenia, had been provoked to assert the last relics of national freedom and hereditary rank, and the ambassadors of Vitiges had secretly traversed the empire to expose the instant and almost inevitable danger of the Kingdom of Italy. Their representations were uniform, weighty, and effectual. "We stand before your throne, the advocates of your interest as well as of our own. The ambitious and faithless Justinian aspires to be the sole master of the world. Since the endless peace which betrayed the common freedom of mankind, that prince, your ally in words, your enemy in actions, has alike insulted his friends and foes and has filled the earth with blood and confusion. Has he not violated the privileges of Armenia, the independence of Colchis, and the wild liberty of the Tsanian mountains? Has he not usurped with equal avidity the city of Bosphorus on the frozen Maeotis, and the vale of palm trees on the shores of the Red Sea? The Moors, the Vandals, the Goths have been successively oppressed, and each nation has calmly remained the spectator of their neighbor's ruin. Embrace, O King, the favorable moment. The East is left without defense, while the armies of Justinian and his renowned general are detained in the distant regions of the West. If you hesitate or delay, Belisarius and his victorious troops will soon return from the Tiber to the Tigris, and Persia may enjoy the wretched consolation of being the last devoured. By such arguments, Chosroes was easily persuaded to imitate the example which he condemned. But the Persian, ambitious of military fame, disdained the inactive warfare of a rival who issued his sanguinary commands from the secure station of the Byzantine palace. Whatever might be the provocations of Chosroes, he abused the confidence of treaties, and the just reproaches of dissimulation and falsehood could only be concealed by the luster of his victories. The Persian army, which had been assembled in the plains of Babylon, prudently declined the strong cities of Mesopotamia and followed the western bank of the Euphrates till the small, though populous, town of Dura presumed to arrest the progress of the great king. The gates of Dura, by treachery and surprise, were burst open, and as soon as Chosroes had stained his scimitar with the blood of the inhabitants, he dismissed the ambassador of Justinian to inform his master in what place he had left the enemy of the Romans. The conqueror still affected the praise of humanity and justice, and as he beheld a noble matron with her infant rudely dragged along the ground, he sighed, he wept, and implored the divine justice to punish the author of these calamities. Yet the herd of 12,000 captives was ransomed for 200 pounds of gold. The neighboring bishop of Sergiopolis pledged his faith for the payment, and in the subsequent year the unfeeling avarice of Chosroes exacted the penalty of an obligation which it was generous to contract and impossible to discharge. He advanced into the heart of Syria, but a feeble enemy who vanished at his approach disappointed him of the honor of victory, and as he could not hope to establish his dominion, the Persian king displayed in this inroad the mean and rapacious vices of a robber. Hierapolis, Beria, or Aleppo, Apamea, and Chalcis were successively besieged. They redeemed their safety by a ransom of gold or silver, proportioned to their respective strength and opulence, and their new master enforced without observing the terms of capitulation. Educated in the religion of the Magi, he exercised without remorse the lucrative trade of sacrilege, and after stripping of its gold and gems a piece of the true cross, he generously restored the naked relic to the devotion of the Christians of Apamea. No more than 14 years had elapsed since Antioch was ruined by an earthquake, but the Queen of the East, the new Theopolis, had been raised from the ground by the liberality of Justinian, and the increasing greatness of the buildings and the people already erased the memory of this recent disaster. On one side the city was defended by the mountain, on the other by the river Orontes, but the most accessible part was commanded by superior eminence. The proper remedies were rejected from the despicable fear of discovering its weakness to the enemy, and Germanus, the emperor's nephew, refused to trust his person and dignity within the walls of a besieged city. The people of Antioch had inherited the vain and satirical genius of their ancestors. They were elated by a sudden reinforcement of 6,000 soldiers. They disdained the offers of an easy capitulation, and their intemperate clamors insulted from the ramparts the majesty of the great king. Under his eye the Persian myriads mounted with scaling ladders to the assault. The Roman mercenaries fled through the opposite gate of Daphne, and the generous assistance of the youth of Antioch served only to aggravate the miseries of their country. As Chosroes, attended by the ambassadors of Justinian, was descending from the mountain, he affected in a plaintive voice to deplore the obstinacy and ruin of that unhappy people. But the slaughter still raged with unrelenting fury, and the city, at the command of a barbarian, was delivered to the flames. The cathedral of Antioch was indeed preserved by the avarice, not the piety, of the conqueror. A more honorable exemption was granted to the church of St. Julian and the quarter of the town where the ambassadors resided. Some distant streets were saved by the shifting of the wind, and the walls still subsisted to protect and soon to betray their new inhabitants. Fanaticism had defaced the ornaments of Daphne, but Chosroes breathed a purer air amidst her groves and fountains, and some idolaters in his train might sacrifice with impunity to the nymphs of that elegant retreat. 18 miles below Antioch, the river Orontes falls into the Mediterranean. The haughty Persian visited the term of his conquests, and after bathing alone in the sea, he offered a solemn sacrifice of thanksgiving to the sun, or rather to the creator of the sun, whom the Magi adored. If this act of superstition offended the prejudices of the Syrians, they were pleased by the courteous and even eager attention with which he assisted at the games of the circus. And as Khosroes had heard that the blue faction was espoused by the emperor, his peremptory command secured the victory of the green charioteer. From the disciple of his camp the people derived more solid consolation, and they interceded in vain for the life of a soldier who had too faithfully copied the rapine of the just Nushirvan. At length, fatigued, though unsatiated with the spoil of Syria, he slowly moved to the Euphrates, formed a temporary bridge in the neighborhood of Barbalissus, and defined the space of 3 days for the entire passage of his numerous host. After his return, he founded at the distance of 1 day's journey from the palace of Ctesiphon a new city which perpetuated the joint names of Khosroes and of Antioch. The Syrian captives recognized the form and situation of their native abodes. Baths and a stately circus were constructed for their use, and a colony of musicians and charioteers revived in Assyria the pleasures of a Greek capital. By the munificence of the royal founder, a liberal allowance was assigned to these fortunate exiles, and they enjoyed the singular privilege of bestowing freedom on the slaves whom they acknowledged as their kinsmen. Palestine and the holy wealth of Jerusalem were the next objects that attracted the ambition, or rather the avarice, of Khosroes. Constantinople and the palace of the Caesars no longer appeared impregnable or remote, and his aspiring fancy already covered Asia Minor with the troops and the Black Sea with the navies of Persia. These hopes might have been realized if the conqueror of Italy had not been seasonably recalled to the defense of the East. While Khosroes pursued his ambitious designs on the coast of the Black Sea, Belisarius, at the head of an army without pay or discipline, encamped beyond the Euphrates within 6 miles of Nisibis. He meditated by a skillful operation to draw the Persians from their impregnable citadel, and, improving his advantage in the field, either to intercept their retreat, or perhaps to enter the gates with the flying barbarians. He advanced 1 day's journey on the territories of Persia, reduced the fortress of Sisorane, and sent the governor with 800 chosen horsemen to serve the emperor in his Italian wars. He detached Aretas and his Arabs, supported by 1,200 Romans, to pass the Tigris, and to ravage the harvests of Assyria, a fruitful province, long exempt from the calamities of war. But the plans of Belisarius were disconcerted by the untractable spirit of Aretas, who neither returned to the camp nor sent any intelligence of his motions. The Roman general was fixed in anxious expectation to the same spot. The time of action elapsed. The ardent sun of Mesopotamia inflamed with fevers the blood of his European soldiers, and the stationary troops and officers of Syria affected to tremble for the safety of their defenseless cities. Yet this diversion had already succeeded in forcing Khosroes to return with loss and precipitation, and if the skill of Belisarius had been seconded by discipline and valor, his success might have satisfied the sanguine wishes of the public, who required at his hands the conquest of Ctesiphon and the deliverance of the captives of Antioch. At the end of the campaign, he was recalled to Constantinople by an ungrateful court, but the dangers of the ensuing spring restored his confidence and command, and the hero, almost alone, was dispatched with the speed of post-horses, to repel, by his name and presence, the invasion of Syria. He found the Roman generals, among whom was a nephew of Justinian, imprisoned by their fears in the fortifications of Hierapolis. But instead of listening to their timid counsels, Belisarius commanded them to follow him to Europus, where he had resolved to collect his forces and to execute whatever God should inspire him to achieve against the enemy. His firm attitude on the banks of the Euphrates restrained Chosroes from advancing towards Palestine, and he received with art and dignity the ambassadors, or rather spies, of the Persian monarch. The plain between Hierapolis and the river was covered with the squadrons of cavalry, 6,000 hunters, tall and robust, who pursued their game without the apprehension of an enemy. On the opposite bank, the ambassadors descried 1,000 Armenian horse, who appeared to guard the passage of the Euphrates. The tent of Belisarius was of the coarsest linen, the simple equipage of a warrior who disdained the luxury of the East. Around his tent, the nations who marched under his standard were arranged with skillful confusion. The Thracians and Illyrians were posted in the front, the Heruli and Goths in the center. The prospect was closed by the Moors and Vandals, and their loose array seemed to multiply their numbers. Their dress was light and active. One soldier carried a whip, another a sword, a third a bow, a fourth, perhaps, a battle-axe, and the whole picture exhibited the intrepidity of the troops and the vigilance of the general. Chosroes was deluded by the address and awed by the genius of the lieutenant of Justinian. Conscious of the merit and ignorant of the force of his antagonist, he dreaded a decisive battle in a distant country from whence not a Persian might return to relate the melancholy tale. The great king hastened to repass the Euphrates, and Belisarius pressed his retreat by affecting to oppose a measure so salutary to the empire, and which could scarcely have been prevented by an army of 100,000 men. Envy might suggest to ignorance and pride that the public enemy had been suffered to escape. But the African and Gothic triumphs are less glorious than this safe and bloodless victory, in which neither fortune nor the valor of the soldiers can subtract any part of the general's renown. The second removal of Belisarius from the Persian to the Italian war revealed the extent of his personal merit, which had corrected or supplied the want of discipline and courage. 15 generals, without concert or skill, led through the mountains of Armenia an army of 30,000 Romans, inattentive to their signals, their ranks, and their ensigns. 4,000 Persians entrenched in the camp of Dubis, vanquished almost without a combat, this disorderly multitude. Their useless arms were scattered along the road, and their horses sunk under the fatigue of their rapid flight. But the Arabs of the Roman party prevailed over their brethren. The Armenians returned to their allegiance. The cities of Dara and Edessa resisted a sudden assault and a regular siege, and the calamities of war were suspended by those of pestilence. A tacit or formal agreement between the two sovereigns protected the tranquillity of the eastern frontier, and the arms of Chosroes were confined to the Colchian or Lazic War, which has been too minutely described by the historians of the times. The extreme length of the Black Sea from Constantinople to the mouth of the Phasis may be computed as a voyage of 9 days and a measure of 700 miles. From the Iberian Caucasus, the most lofty and craggy mountains of Asia, that river descends with such oblique vehemence that in a short space it is traversed by 120 bridges. Nor does the stream become placid and navigable till it reaches the town of Sarapana, 5 days' journey from the Cyrus, which flows from the same hills, but in a contrary direction to the Caspian Lake. The proximity of these rivers has suggested the practice, or at least the idea, of wafting the precious merchandise of India down the Oxus, over the Caspian, up the Cyrus, and with the current of the Phasis into the Black and Mediterranean seas. As it successively collects the streams of the plain of Colchis, the Phasis moves with diminished speed, though accumulated weight. At the mouth it is 60 fathoms deep, and half a league broad, but a small woody island is interposed in the midst of the channel. The water, so soon as it has deposited an earthy or metallic sediment, floats on the surface of the waves and is no longer susceptible of corruption. In a course of 100 miles, 40 of which are navigable for large vessels, the Phasis divides the celebrated region of Colchis, or Mingrelia, which on three sides is fortified by the Iberian and Armenian mountains, and whose maritime coast extends about 200 miles from the neighbourhood of Trebizond to Dioscurius and the confines of Circassia. Both the soil and climate are relaxed by excessive moisture. 28 rivers, besides the Phasis and his dependent streams, convey their waters to the sea, and the hollowness of the ground appears to indicate these subterraneous channels between the Black Sea and the Caspian. In the fields where wheat or barley is sown, the earth is too soft to sustain the action of the plough, but the gome, a small grain not unlike the millet or coriander seed, supplies the ordinary food of the people, and the use of bread is confined to the prince and his nobles. Yet the vintage is more plentiful than the harvest, and the bulk of the stems, as well as the quality of the wine, display the unassisted powers of nature. The same powers continually tend to overshadow the face of the country with thick forests. The timber of the hills and the flax of the plains contribute to the abundance of naval stores. The wild and tame animals, the horse, the ox, and the hog, are remarkably prolific, and the name of the pheasant is expressive of his native habitation on the banks of the Phasis. The gold mines to the south of Trebizond, which are still worked with sufficient profit, were a subject of national dispute between Justinian and Chosroes, and it is not unreasonable to believe that a vein of precious metal may be equally diffused through the circle of the hills, although these secret treasures are neglected by the laziness or concealed by the prudence of the Mingrelians. The waters, impregnated with particles of gold, are carefully strained through sheepskins or fleeces. But this expedient, the groundwork perhaps of a marvellous fable, affords a faint image of the wealth extracted from a virgin earth by the power and industry of ancient kings. Their silver palaces and golden chambers surpass our belief, but the fame of their riches is said to have excited the enterprising avarice of the Argonauts. Tradition has affirmed, with some color of reason, that Egypt planted on the Phasis a learned and polite colony which manufactured linen, built navies, and invented geographical maps. The ingenuity of the moderns has peopled with flourishing cities and nations the isthmus between the Black Sea and the Caspian, and a lively writer, observing the resemblance of climate and in his apprehension of trade, has not hesitated to pronounce Colchis the Holland of antiquity. But the riches of Colchis shine only through the darkness of conjecture or tradition, and its genuine history presents a uniform scene of rudeness and poverty. If 130 languages were spoken in the market of Dioscurius, they were the imperfect idioms of so many savage tribes or families sequestered from each other in the valleys of Mount Caucasus, and their separation, which diminished the importance, must have multiplied the number of their rustic capitals. In the present state of Mingrelia, a village is an assemblage of huts within a wooden fence. The fortresses are seated in the depths of forests. The princely town of Kita, or Kutatis, consists of 200 houses, and a stone edifice appertains only to the magnificence of kings. 12 ships from Constantinople, and about 60 barks, laden with the fruits of industry, annually cast anchor on the coast, and the list of Colchian exports is much increased, since the natives had only slaves and hides to offer in exchange for the corn and salt which they purchased from the subjects of Justinian. Not a vestige can be found of the art, the knowledge, or the navigation of the ancient Colchians. Few Greeks desired or dared to pursue the footsteps of the Argonauts, and even the marks of an Egyptian colony are lost in a nearer approach. The rite of circumcision is practiced only by the Mohammedans of the Black Sea, and the curled hair and swarthy complexion of Africa no longer disfigured the most perfect of the human race. It is in the adjacent climates of Georgia, Mingrelia, and Circassia that nature has placed, at least to our eyes, the model of beauty in the shape of the limbs, the color of the skin, the symmetry of the features, and the expression of the countenance. According to the destination of the two sexes, the men seemed formed for action, the women for love, and the perpetual supply of females from Mount Caucasus has purified the blood and improved the breed of the southern nations of Asia. The proper district of Mingrelia, a portion only of the ancient Colchos, has long sustained an exportation of 12,000 slaves. The number of prisoners or criminals would be inadequate to the annual demand, but the common people are in a state of servitude to their lords. The exercise of fraud or rapine is unpunished in a lawless community, and the market is continually replenished by the abuse of civil and paternal authority. Such a trade, which reduces the human species to the level of cattle, may tend to encourage marriage and population, since the multitude of children enriches their sordid and inhuman parent. But this source of impure wealth must inevitably poison the national manners, obliterate the sense of honor and virtue, and almost extinguish the instincts of nature. The Christians of Georgia and Mingrelia are the most dissolute of mankind, and their children, who in a tender age are sold into foreign slavery, have already learned to imitate the rapine of the father and the prostitution of the mother. Yet amidst the rudest ignorance, the untaught natives discover a singular dexterity both of mind and hand, and although the want of union and discipline exposes them to their more powerful neighbors, a bold and intrepid spirit has animated the Colchians of every age. In the host of Xerxes they served on foot, and their arms were a dagger or a javelin, a wooden casque, and a buckler of raw hides. But in their own country the use of cavalry has more generally prevailed. The meanest of the peasants disdain to walk. The martial nobles are possessed, perhaps, of 200 horses, and above 5,000 are numbered in the train of the Prince of Mingrelia. The Colchian government has been always a pure and hereditary kingdom, and the authority of the sovereign is only restrained by the turbulence of his subjects. Whenever they were obedient, he could lead a numerous army into the field. But some faith is requisite to believe that the single tribe of the Suanians, as composed of 200,000 soldiers, or that the population of Mingrelia now amounts to 4 millions of inhabitants. Part 4. It was the boast of the Colchians that their ancestors had checked the victories of Sesostris, and the defeat of the Egyptian is less incredible than his successful progress as far as the foot of Mount Caucasus. They sunk without any memorable effort under the arms of Cyrus, followed in distant wars the standard of the great king, and presented him every 5th year with 100 boys and as many virgins, the fairest produce of the land. Yet he accepted this gift, like the gold and ebony of India, the frankincense of the Arabs, or the negroes and ivory of Ethiopia. The Colchians were not subject to the dominion of a satrap, and they continued to enjoy the name as well as substance of national independence. After the fall of the Persian Empire, Mithridates, king of Pontus, added Colchis to the wide circle of his dominions on the Black Sea, and when the natives presumed to request that his son might reign over them, he bound the ambitious youth in chains of gold and delegated a servant in his place. In the pursuit of Mithridates, the Romans advanced to the banks of the Phasis, and their galleys ascended the river till they reached the camp of Pompey and his legions. But the Senate, and afterwards the emperors, disdained to reduce that distant and useless conquest into the form of a province. The family of a Greek rhetorician was permitted to reign in Colchis and the adjacent kingdoms from the time of Mark Antony to that of Nero. And after the race of Palaemon was extinct, The eastern Pontus, which preserved his name, extended no farther than the neighbourhood of Trebizond. Beyond these limits, the fortifications of Hysus, of Apsaras, of the Phasis, of Dioscurius, or Sebastopolis, and of Pityus, were guarded by sufficient detachments of horse and foot, and six princes of Colchis received their diadems from the lieutenants of Caesar. One of these lieutenants, the eloquent and philosophic Arian, surveyed and has described the Black Sea coast under the reign of Hadrian. The garrison which he reviewed at the mouth of the Phasis consisted of 400 chosen legionaries. The brick walls and towers, the double ditch, and the military engines on the rampart rendered this place inaccessible to the barbarians. But the new suburbs which had been built by the merchants and veterans required, in the opinion of Arian, some external defense. As the strength of the empire was gradually impaired, the Romans stationed on the Phasis were neither withdrawn nor expelled, and the tribes of the Lazi, whose posterity speak a foreign dialect and inhabit the seacoast of Trebizond, imposed their name and dominion on the ancient kingdom of Colchis. Their independence was soon invaded by a formidable neighbor who had acquired, by arms and treaties, the sovereignty of Iberia. The dependent king of Lazica received his scepter at the hands of the Persian monarch, and the successors of Constantine acquiesced in this injurious claim, which was proudly urged as a right of immemorial prescription. In the beginning of the 6th century, their influence was restored by the introduction of Christianity, which the Mingrelians still profess with becoming zeal, without understanding the doctrines or observing the precepts of their religion. After the decease of his father, Zathus was exalted to the regal dignity by the favor of the great king. But the pious youth abhorred the ceremonies of the Magi, and sought in the palace of Constantinople an orthodox baptism, a noble wife, and the alliance of the emperor Justin. The king of Lazica was solemnly invested with the diadem, and his cloak and tunic of white silk, with a gold border, displayed in rich embroidery the figure of his new patron, who soothed the jealousy of the Persian court, and excused the revolt of Colchis by the venerable names of hospitality and religion. The common interest of both empires imposed on the Colchians the duty of guarding the passes of Mount Caucasus, where a wall of 60 miles is now defended by the monthly service of the musketeers of Mingrelia. But this honorable connection was soon corrupted by the avarice and ambition of the Romans. Degraded from the rank of allies, the Lazi were incessantly reminded by words and actions of their dependent state. At the distance of a day's journey beyond the Apsaras, they beheld the rising fortress of Petra, which commanded the maritime country to the south of the Phasis. Instead of being protected by the valor, Colchis was insulted by the licentiousness of foreign mercenaries. The benefits of commerce were converted into base and vexatious monopoly, and Gubazes, the native prince, was reduced to a pageant of royalty by the superior influence of the officers of Justinian. Disappointed in their expectations of Christian virtue, the indignant Lazi reposed some confidence in the justice of an unbeliever. After a private assurance that their ambassadors should not be delivered to the Romans, they publicly solicited the friendship and aid of Chosroes. The sagacious monarch instantly discerned the use and importance of Colchis, and meditated a plan of conquest which was renewed at the end of 1,000 years by Shah Abbas, the wisest and most powerful of his successors. His ambition was fired by the hope of launching a Persian navy from the Phasis, of commanding the trade and navigation of the Black Sea, of desolating the coast of Pontus and Bithynia, of distressing, perhaps of attacking, Constantinople, and of persuading the barbarians of Europe to second his arms and counsels against the common enemy of mankind. Under the pretense of a Scythian war, he silently led his troops to the frontiers of Iberia. The Colchian guides were prepared to conduct them through the woods and along the precipices of Mount Caucasus, and a narrow path was laboriously formed into a safe and spacious highway for the march of cavalry and even of elephants. Gubazes laid his person and diadem at the feet of the king of Persia. His Colchians imitated the submission of their prince, and after the walls of Petra had been shaken, the Roman garrison prevented by capitulation the impending fury of the last assault. But the lazy soon discovered that their impatience had urged them to choose an evil more intolerable than the calamities which they strove to escape. The monopoly of salt and corn was effectually removed by the loss of those valuable commodities. The authority of a Roman legislator was succeeded by the pride of an Oriental despot, who beheld with equal disdain the slaves whom he had exalted and the kings whom he had humbled before the footstool of his throne. The adoration of fire was introduced into Colchis by the zeal of the Magi. Their intolerant spirit provoked the fervor of a Christian people, and the prejudice of nature or education was wounded by the impious practice of exposing the dead bodies of their parents on the summit of a lofty tower to the crows and vultures of the air. Conscious of the increasing hatred which retarded the execution of his great designs, the just Nashirvan had secretly given orders to assassinate the king of the lazy, to transplant the people into some distant land, and to fix a faithful and warlike colony on the banks of the Phasis. The watchful jealousy of the Colchians foresaw and averted the approaching ruin. Their repentance was accepted at Constantinople by the prudence, rather than clemency, of Justinian, and he commanded Dagestius, with 7,000 Romans and 1,000 of the Zani, to expel the Persians from the coast of the Black Sea. The siege of Petra, which the Roman general, with the aid of the lazy, immediately undertook, is one of the most remarkable actions of the age. The city was seated on a craggy rock, which hung over the sea and communicated by a steep and narrow path with the land. Since the approach was difficult, the attack might be deemed impossible. The Persian conqueror had strengthened the fortifications of Justinian, and the places least inaccessible were covered by additional bulwarks. In this important fortress, the vigilance of Chosroes had deposited a magazine of offensive and defensive arms, sufficient for 5 times the number, not only of the garrison, but of the besiegers themselves. The stock of flour and salt provisions was adequate to the consumption of 5 years. The want of wine was supplied by vinegar, and of grain, from whence a strong liquor was extracted, and a triple aqueduct eluded the diligence and even the suspicions of the enemy. But the firmest defense of Petra was placed in the valor of 1,500 Persians, who resisted the assaults of the Romans, whilst in a softer vein of earth, a mine was secretly perforated. The wall, supported by slender and temporary props, hung tottering in the air, but Dagestius delayed the attack till he had secured a specific recompense, and the town was relieved before the return of his messenger from Constantinople. The Persian garrison was reduced to 400 men, of whom no more than 50 were exempt from sickness or wounds. Yet such had been their inflexible perseverance that they concealed their losses from the enemy by enduring, without a murmur, the sight and putrefying stench of the dead bodies of their 1,100 companions. After their deliverance, the breaches were hastily stopped with sandbags. The mine was replenished with earth. A new wall was erected on a frame of substantial timber, and a fresh garrison of 3,000 men was stationed at Petra to sustain the labors of a second siege. The operations, both of the attack and defense, were conducted with skillful obstinacy, and each party derived useful lessons from the experience of their past faults. A battering ram was invented of light construction and powerful effect. It was transported and worked by the hands of 40 soldiers, and as the stones were loosened by its repeated strokes, they were torn with long iron hooks from the wall. From those walls a shower of darts was incessantly poured on the heads of the assailants, but they were most dangerously annoyed by fiery composition of sulphur and bitumen, which in Colchis might with some propriety be named the oil of Medea. Of 6,000 Romans who mounted the scaling ladders, their general Bessus was the first, a gallant veteran of 70 years of age. The courage of their leader, his fall and extreme danger, animated the irresistible effort of his troops, and their prevailing numbers oppressed the strength without subduing the spirit of the Persian garrison. The fate of these valiant men deserves to be more distinctly noticed. 700 had perished in the siege, 2,300 survived to defend the breach. 1,070 were destroyed with fire and sword in the last assault, and if 730 were made prisoners, only 18 among them were found without the marks of honorable wounds. The remaining 500 escaped into the citadel, which they maintained without any hopes of relief, rejecting the fairest terms of capitulation and service, till they were lost in the flames. They died in obedience to the commands of their prince, and such examples of loyalty and valor might excite their countrymen to deeds of equal despair and more prosperous event. The distant demolition of the works of Petra confessed the astonishment and apprehension of the conqueror. A Spartan would have praised and pitied the virtue of these heroic slaves, but the tedious warfare and alternate success of the Roman and Persian arms cannot detain the attention of posterity at the foot of Mount Caucasus. The advantages obtained by the troops of Justinian were more frequent and splendid, but the forces of the great king were continually supplied, till they amounted to 8 elephants and 70,000 men, including 12,000 Scythian allies and above 3,000 Delamites, who descended by their free choice from the hills of Hyrcania, and were equally formidable in close or in distant combat. The siege of Archaeopolis, a name imposed or corrupted by the Greeks, was raised with some loss and precipitation, but the Persians occupied the passes of Iberia. Colchis was enslaved by their forts and garrisons. They devoured the scanty sustenance of the people, and the prince of the lazy fled into the mountains. In the Roman camp, faith and discipline were unknown, and the independent leaders who were invested with equal power disputed with each other the preeminence of vice and corruption. The Persians followed, without a murmur, the commands of a single chief, who implicitly obeyed the instructions of their supreme lord. Their general was distinguished among the heroes of the East by his wisdom in council and his valor in the field. The advanced age of Mermeroes and the lameness of both his feet could not diminish the activity of his mind or even of his body. And whilst he was carried in a litter in the front of battle, he inspired terror to the enemy and a just confidence to the troops, who under his banners were always successful. After his death, the command devolved to Nacaragan, a proud satrap who, in a conference with the imperial chiefs, had presumed to declare that he disposed of victory as absolutely as of the ring on his finger. Such presumption was the natural cause and forerunner of a shameful defeat. The Romans had been gradually repulsed to the edge of the seashore, and their last camp on the ruins of the Grecian colony of Phasis was defended on all sides by strong entrenchments, the river, the Black Sea, and a fleet of galleys. Despair united their counsels and invigorated their arms. They withstood the assault of the Persians, and the flight of Nacaragan preceded or followed the slaughter of 10,000 of his bravest soldiers. He escaped from the Romans to fall into the hands of an unforgiving master who severely chastised the error of his own choice. The unfortunate general was flayed alive, and his skin, stuffed into the human form, was exposed on a mountain, a dreadful warning to those who might hereafter be entrusted with the fame and fortune of Persia. Yet the prudence of Khosroes insensibly relinquished the prosecution of the Colchian War in the just persuasion that it is impossible to reduce, or at least to hold, a distant country against the wishes and efforts of its inhabitants. The fidelity of Gubaziz sustained the most rigorous trials. He patiently endured the hardships of a savage life and rejected with disdain the specious temptations of the Persian court. The king of the lazy had been educated in the Christian religion. His mother was the daughter of a senator. During his youth, he had served 10 years a silentiary of the Byzantine palace, and the arrears of an unpaid salary were a motive of attachment as well as of complaint. But the long continuance of his sufferings extorted from him a naked representation of the truth, and truth was an unpardonable libel on the lieutenants of Justinian, who, amidst the delays of a ruinous war, had spared his enemies and trampled on his allies. Their malicious information persuaded the emperor that his faithless vassal already meditated a second defection. An order was surprised to send him prisoner to Constantinople. A treacherous clause was inserted that he might be lawfully killed in case of resistance. And Gubaziz, without arms or suspicion of danger, was stabbed in the security of a friendly interview. In the first moments of rage and despair, the Colchians would have sacrificed their country and religion to the gratification of revenge. But the authority and eloquence of the wiser few obtained a salutary pause. The victory of the Phasis restored the terror of the Roman arms, and the emperor was solicitous to absolve his own name from the imputation of so foul a murder. A judge of senatorial rank was commissioned to inquire into the conduct and death of the king of the lazy. He ascended a stately tribunal, encompassed by the ministers of justice and punishment. In the presence of both nations, this extraordinary cause was pleaded according to the forms of civil jurisprudence, and some satisfaction was granted to an injured people by the sentence and execution of the meaner criminals. In peace, the king of Persia continually sought the pretenses of a rupture, but no sooner had he taken up arms than he expressed his desire of a safe and honorable treaty. During the fiercest hostilities, the two monarchs entertained a deceitful negotiation, and such was the superiority of Khosroes that whilst he treated the Roman ministers with insolence and contempt, he obtained the most unprecedented honors for his own ambassadors at the imperial court. The successor of Cyrus assumed the majesty of the eastern sun, and graciously permitted his younger brother Justinian to reign over the west with the pale and reflected splendor of the moon. This gigantic style was supported by the pomp and eloquence of Izdigune, one of the royal chamberlains. His wife and daughters, with a train of eunuchs and camels, attended the march of the ambassador. Two satraps with golden diadems were numbered among his followers. He was guarded by 500 horse, the most valiant of the Persians, and the Roman governor of Dara wisely refused to admit more than 20 of this martial and hostile caravan. When Izdigune had saluted the emperor and delivered his presents, he passed 10 months at Constantinople without discussing any serious affairs. Instead of being confined to his palace and receiving food and water from the hands of his keepers, the Persian ambassador, without spies or guards, was allowed to visit the capital, and the freedom of conversation and trade enjoyed by his domestics offended the prejudices of an age which rigorously practiced the law of nations without confidence or courtesy. By an unexampled indulgence, his interpreter, a servant below the notice of a Roman magistrate, was seated at the table of Justinian by the side of his master, and 1,000 pounds of gold might be assigned for the expense of his journey and entertainment. Yet the repeated labors of Izdigune could procure only a partial and imperfect truce, which was always purchased with the treasures and renewed at the solicitation of the Byzantine court. Many years of fruitless desolation elapsed before Justinian and Khosroes were compelled, by mutual lassitude, to consult the repose of their declining age. At a conference held on the frontier, each party, without expecting to gain credit, displayed the power, the justice, and the pacific intentions of their respective sovereigns. But necessity and interest dictated the treaty of peace, which was concluded for a term of 50 years, diligently composed in the Greek and Persian languages, and attested by the seals of 12 interpreters. The liberty of commerce and religion was fixed and defined. The allies of the emperor and the great king were included in the same benefits and obligations, and the most scrupulous precautions were provided to prevent or determine the accidental disputes that might arise on the confines of two hostile nations. After 20 years of destructive, though feeble, war, the limits still remained without alteration, and Chosroes was persuaded to renounce his dangerous claim to the possession or sovereignty of Colchis and its dependent states. Rich in the accumulated treasures of the East, he extorted from the Romans an annual payment of 30,000 pieces of gold, and the smallness of the sum revealed the disgrace of a tribute in its naked deformity. In a previous debate, the chariot of Sesostris and the wheel of fortune were applied by one of the ministers of Justinian, who observed that the reduction of Antioch and some Syrian cities had elevated beyond measure the vain and ambitious spirit of the barbarian. "You are mistaken," replied the modest Persian. "The King of Kings, the Lord of Mankind, looks down with contempt on such petty acquisitions, and of the 10 nations vanquished by his invincible arms, he esteems the Romans as the least formidable." According to the Orientals, the empire of Nushirvan extended from Fergana in Transoxiana to Yemen, or Arabia Felix. He subdued the rebels of Hyrcania, reduced the provinces of Kabul and Zablistan on the banks of the Indus, broke the power of the Euthyletes, terminated by an honorable treaty the Turkish War, and admitted the daughter of the great Khan into the number of his lawful wives. Victorious and respected among the princes of Asia, he gave audience in his palace of Madain, or Ctesiphon, to the ambassadors of the world. Their gifts or tributes, arms, rich garments, gems, slaves, or aromatics, were humbly presented at the foot of his throne, and he condescended to accept from the king of India 10 quintals of the wood of aloe, a maid 7 cubits in height, and a carpet softer than silk, the skin, as it was reported, of an extraordinary serpent. Justinian had been reproached for his alliance with the Ethiopians, as if he attempted to introduce a people of savage Negroes into the system of civilized society. But the friends of the Roman Empire, the Axumites or Abyssinians, may be always distinguished from the original natives of Africa. The hand of nature has flattened the noses of the Negroes, covered their heads with shaggy wool, and tinged their skin with inherent and indelible blackness. But the olive complexion of the Abyssinians, their hair, shape, and features, distinctly mark them as a colony of Arabs. And this descent is confirmed by the resemblance of language and manners, the report of an ancient immigration, and the narrow interval between the shores of the Red Sea. Christianity had raised that nation above the level of African barbarism. Their intercourse with Egypt and the successors of Constantine had communicated the rudiments of the arts and sciences. Their vessels traded to the Isle of Ceylon, and 7 kingdoms obeyed the Negus, or Supreme Prince, of Abyssinia. The independence of the Homerites, who reigned in the rich and happy Arabia, was first violated by an Ethiopian conqueror. He drew his hereditary claim from the Queen of Sheba, and his ambition was sanctified by religious zeal. The Jews, powerful and active in exile, had seduced the mind of Dunan, prince of the Homerites. They urged him to retaliate the persecution inflicted by the imperial laws on their unfortunate brethren. Some Roman merchants were injuriously treated, and several Christians of Negra were honored with the crown of martyrdom. The churches of Arabia implored the protection of the Abyssinian monarch. The Negus passed the Red Sea with a fleet and army, deprived the Jewish proselyte of his kingdom and life, and extinguished a race of princes who had ruled above 2,000 years the sequestered region of myrrh and frankincense. The conqueror immediately announced the victory of the gospel, requested an Orthodox patriarch, and so warmly professed his friendship to the Roman Empire that Justinian was flattered by the hope of diverting the silk trade through the channel of Abyssinia and of exciting the forces of Arabia against the Persian king. Nonosus, descended from a family of ambassadors, was named by the emperor to execute this important commission. He wisely declined the shorter but more dangerous road through the sanded deserts of Nubia, ascended the Nile, embarked on the Red Sea, and safely landed at the African port of Adulis. From Adulis to the royal city of Oxum is no more than 50 leagues in a direct line, but the winding passes of the mountains detained the ambassador 15 days, and as he traversed the forests, he saw and vaguely computed about 5,000 wild elephants. The capital, according to his report, was large and populous, and the village of Oxum is still conspicuous by the regal coronations, by the ruins of a Christian temple, and by 16 or 17 obelisks inscribed with Grecian characters. But the Negus gave audience in the open field, seated on a lofty chariot which was drawn by 4 elephants, superbly caparisoned, and surrounded by his nobles and musicians. He was clad in a linen garment and cap, holding in his hand 2 javelins and a light shield. And although his nakedness was imperfectly covered, he displayed the barbaric pomp of gold chains, collars, and bracelets, richly adorned with pearls and precious stones. The ambassador of Justinian knelt. The Negus raised him from the ground, embraced Nonosus, kissed the seal, perused the letter, accepted the Roman alliance, and, brandishing his weapons, denounced implacable war against the worshippers of fire. But the proposal of the silk trade was eluded, and notwithstanding the assurances and perhaps the wishes of the Abyssinians, these hostile menaces evaporated without effect. The Homerites were unwilling to abandon their aromatic groves to explore a sandy desert and to encounter, after all their fatigues, a formidable nation from whom they had never received any personal injuries. Instead of enlarging his conquests, the king of Ethiopia was incapable of defending his possessions. Abraha, the slave of a Roman merchant of Adulis, assumed the scepter of the Homerites. The troops of Africa were seduced by the luxury of the climate, and Justinian solicited the friendship of the usurper, who honored with a slight tribute the supremacy of his prince. After a long series of prosperity, the power of Abraha was overthrown before the gates of Mecca, and his children were despoiled by the Persian conqueror, and the Ethiopians were finally expelled from the continent of Asia. This narrative of obscure and remote events is not foreign to the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. If a Christian power had been maintained in Arabia, Mohammed must have been crushed in his cradle, and Abyssinia would have prevented a revolution which has changed the civil and religious state of the world. Chapter 43. Rebellions of Africa. Restoration of the Gothic Kingdom by Totila. Loss and recovery of Rome. Final conquest of Italy by Narses. Extinction of the Ostrogoths. Defeat of the Franks and Alemanni. Last victory, disgrace, and death of Belisarius. Death and character of Justinian. Comet, earthquakes, and plague. Part 1. The review of the nations from the Danube to the Nile has exposed on every side the weakness of the Romans, and our wonder is reasonably excited that they should presume to enlarge an empire whose ancient limits they were incapable of defending. But the wars, the conquests, and the triumphs of Justinian are the feeble and pernicious efforts of old age, which exhaust the remains of strength and accelerate the decay of the powers of life. He exulted in the glorious act of restoring Africa and Italy to the Republic. But the calamities which followed the departure of Belisarius betrayed the impotence of the conqueror and accomplished the ruin of those unfortunate countries. From his new acquisitions, Justinian expected that his avarice, as well as pride, should be richly gratified. A rapacious minister of the finances closely pursued the footsteps of Belisarius, and as the old registers of tribute had been burnt by the Vandals, he indulged his fancy in a liberal calculation and arbitrary assessment of the wealth of Africa. The increase of taxes which were drawn away by a distant sovereign and a general resumption of the patrimony or crown lands soon dispelled the intoxication of the public joy, but the emperor was insensible to the modest complaints of the people till he was awakened and alarmed by the clamors of military discontent. Many of the Roman soldiers had married the widows and daughters of the Vandals. As their own, by the double right of conquest and inheritance, they claimed the estates which Genseric had assigned to his victorious troops. They heard with disdain the cold and selfish representations of their officers that the liberality of Justinian had raised them from a savage or servile condition, that they were already enriched by the spoils of Africa, the treasure, the slaves, and the movables of the vanquished barbarians, and that the ancient and lawful patrimony of the emperors would be applied only to the support of that government on which their own safety and reward must ultimately depend. The mutiny was secretly inflamed by 1,000 soldiers, for the most part heruli, who had imbibed the doctrines and were instigated by the clergy of the Arian sect. And the cause of perjury and rebellion was sanctified by the dispensing powers of fanaticism. The Arians deplored the ruin of their church, triumphant above a century in Africa, and they were justly provoked by the laws of the conqueror, which interdicted the baptism of their children and the exercise of all religious worship. Of the Vandals chosen by Belisarius, the far greater part in the honors of the Eastern service forgot their country and religion. But a generous band of 400 obliged the mariners, when they were in sight of the Isle of Lesbos, to alter their course. They touched on Peloponnesus, ran ashore on a desert coast of Africa, and boldly erected on Mount Aurasius the standard of independence and revolt. While the troops of the provinces disclaimed the commands of their superiors, a conspiracy was formed at Carthage against the life of Solomon, who filled with honor the place of Belisarius. And the Arians had piously resolved to sacrifice the tyrant at the foot of the altar during the awful mysteries of the festival of Easter. Fear or remorse restrained the daggers of the assassins, but the patience of Solomon emboldened their discontent. And at the end of 10 days, a furious sedition was kindled in the circus, which desolated Africa above 10 years. The pillage of the city and the indiscriminate slaughter of its inhabitants were suspended only by darkness, sleep, and intoxication. The governor, with 7 companions, among whom was the historian Procopius, escaped to Sicily. 2/3 of the army were involved in the guilt of treason, and 8,000 insurgents, assembling in the field of Bulla, elected Stoza for their chief, a private soldier who possessed in a superior degree the virtues of a rebel. Under the mask of freedom, his eloquence could lead, or at least impel, the passions of his equals. He raised himself to a level with Belisarius and the nephew of the emperor by daring to encounter them in the field, and the victorious generals were compelled to acknowledge that Stoza deserved a purer cause and a more legitimate command. Vanquished in battle, he dexterously employed the arts of negotiation. A Roman army was seduced from their allegiance, and the chiefs who had trusted to his faithless promise were murdered by his order in a church of Numidia. When every resource, either of force or perfidy, was exhausted, Stoza, with some desperate Vandals, retired to the wilds of Mauritania, obtained the daughter of a barbarian prince, and eluded the pursuit of his enemies by the report of his death